Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. I'm glad you could be with us. Today we're going to have our main interview with an author of a new book. His name is Nate Blakeslee, and his book, Tulia, Race, Cocaine, and Corruption in a Small Texas Town. And if you're a regular listener, you know what we're talking about, but whether you've heard the story or not, I think you need to understand it a little better, and Mr. Blakeslee is the one to help us here. I think we do have him online. Let's bring him aboard. Mr. Blakeslee?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
Good evening, sir. Yes, I want you to, if you will, tell the folks a bit about yourself, your work history, and your new book.
Yeah, sure. I was born and raised in Arlington, Texas. I started working as a reporter for Texas Observer magazine here in Austin, which is where I live now. And we actually broke the Tulia story in the Observer back in the summer of 2000. And then over the last couple years, I expanded that story into a book, which is out from Public Affairs Press. And it's called Tulia, Race, Cocaine, and Corruption in a Small Texas Town.
And I tell you what, I went to Barnes & Noble to get a copy, and they were sold out. I guess that's probably a good sign for you.
Yes, that is good news.
Yes, sir. And again, for those who don't know Tulia, who don't know about this situation, tell them the Tulia story, if you would. Summarize it.
Well, it's become one of the biggest drug war scandals, certainly in recent years, and probably is going to go down as one of the best remembered scandals of the decade. It happened in the late 90s in a little panhandle town up near Amarillo, a town called Tulia, which is a little farming and ranching town of about 5,000 people. And in the summer of 99, they had an enormous drug bust in Tulia. 47 people were busted, and it made headlines because it was one of the biggest busts in the state that year, and because the town was so small, it was such an amazing thing that somebody had busted 47 people. All of them were made by one single narcotics officer. He was named Officer of the Year. The drug task force he worked for was Task Force of the Year. The other unusual thing about the bust was the racial composition. There were only about maybe 250, 300 black citizens in Tulia, and 39 of the 47 people he busted were black. So they actually rounded up 1 in 5 black adults in this single bust. And that generated some publicity, a few stories sort of questioning the racial composition of the bust. But that was about it. And then by the time the Texas Observer got onto the story, the news in Tulia had sort of died down. And I went out there originally just to do a story about the sentences from the bust, because nobody was accused of dealing more than a couple hundred dollars worth of cocaine, but the sentences were just amazingly long. The first man got 90 years. One young man, the jury ordered his sentences stacked. He got 340 years. So I thought I would just go out and talk to some jurors about, you know, what was it about dealing small amounts of cocaine that you thought, you know, was morally equivalent to murdering somebody, because that was the kind of sentences they were getting. And then it wasn't until I got out there that I realized, after talking to some of the defense attorneys, that there really was a question about whether the cases were even good to begin with. And then it became more of a story about a corrupt narcotics officer.
Well, let's talk about that officer. His name, Mr. Tom Coleman, he was actually found guilty of perjury eventually, was he not?
Yeah, just this past winter he was convicted of perjury.
And Mr. Coleman had his own problems with the law. He had actually been arrested during this investigation, was he not?
Yeah, that was sort of the first big jaw dropper. And that was the first thing that blew me away when I went down to talk to defense attorneys, is that the man had, as you said, had actually been wanted in another county during the time that he was running this undercover operation in Tulia. Coleman was the son of a really well-known Texas Ranger from West Texas, kind of a law enforcement royalty family from out there. And what he would do is he'd play on his dad's name to get these little deputy jobs in these little one-horse towns. But Coleman himself was just a terrible cop. And his M.O. was he'd go to these little towns, he'd weasel his way into a job, he'd run up bills all over town, he'd get everybody in town mad at him, and finally he'd just leave in the middle of a shift. He did that two times in the mid-90s. Second time he did it, the sheriff filed charges on him. And so that was the indictment that was uncovered during the time Coleman was operating at Tulia. And the amazing thing was that the sheriff in Tulia, he finds this warrant for his own narc's arrest, and he decides he's just going to handle it, he's just going to cover it up. He arrests him as quietly as possible, doesn't ask too many questions about the cause of it, lets him take a week off to resolve the issue, and then hides the information from defense attorneys until all these trials are already in the can, two dozen people already in prison.
Now, what we're talking about here sounds a whole lot like a railroad situation. I know the judge, basically, what's his name, Ed Self, had no fallout yet from this, but the district attorney, Mr. Terry McEachern, was not reelected the last go-round. Describe his situation, if you would.
Well, when everything finally hit the fan, we filed our story in The Observer, and then it got picked up by the New York Times, and it became a big national story. And eventually, this great team of pro bono attorneys, most of them from big firms in Washington, D.C., and also a local attorney from Amarillo named Jeff Blackburn, and some great local organizers there in Tulia, got together to fight this thing, and they forced a big hearing in the spring of 2003. And that's sort of when everything came apart. And eventually, all of the cases that Coleman made in Tulia were thrown out. 13 people were still in prison at that point, and they were released. And as you say, McEachern, there was a grievance filed against him at the bar, but he got a slap on the wrist for that. And then he actually did lose in the primary election for the next election after the big hearing. But it wasn't principally because of the Tulia scandal. It was because he got a DWI of his own shortly before the election. That's what did him in.
Wow. Well, a little serendipity there of some kind. Now, let me ask you this. The situation that happened in Tulia, it's not a rarity. Maybe the number makes it a rarity to arrest 37 out of 47 or whatever blacks in one day.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think? Is it not repeated house by house, neighborhood by neighborhood across America?
Well, that's what I usually tell people is that it's not sort of unusual in kind. It's only unusual in degree. And then, you know, if Coleman had done a less ambitious fraud, you know, if he'd only, say, set up cases maybe against 10 people instead of 47, he probably would have got away with it. But the M.O. of the operation is very common. He worked for one of these burn drug task forces, which are federally funded drug task forces that are manned by local sheriffs and deputies, usually in rural or suburban areas. In the late 90s, we had about 50 of them across the state of Texas. And if you've ever been pulled over and searched on the side of the highway, it was probably one of these burn grant task forces that did it. That's sort of what they do. They do the highway interdiction, which is basically just stopping cars over and over and over again until they get lucky. Or they do these low-level undercover jobs where they'll send a narc into a community and try to bust as many what they call low-level dealers as they can. A lot of times they just bust addicts. They set addicts up as dealers and bust them. And that was the kind of operation that Coleman was hired to do in Tulia. And I think they thought he would probably get about 8 or 10 young men that sort of everybody in town knew were mixed up with crack and sort of the neighborhood ne'er-do-wells. And instead, he just kept filing case after case after case until he'd implicated 47 different people.
Well, I want to remind the listeners they are listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network. We bring you the unvarnished truth about the drug war. Our guest today is Nate Blakeslee. He's the author of a new book, Tulia, Race, Cocaine, and Corruption in a Small Texas Town. Nate, let me ask you this. Here in Houston, we arrest approximately 90 people every day. A large number of them are people of color, and they fall into that same tar pit, if you will, that they can't afford the lawyers, they can't afford the bail, and they take the lesser sentence, and they're sentenced to prison on a regular basis. Your thoughts on that, sir? Is it not everywhere and to one degree or another?
Yeah, I think the drug war is caught in a terrible cycle of just what you've described, of busting the same sort of low-level guys over and over and over again. They get a little bit of prison time, then they get out, and then they bust them again. And, you know, you and I are not the only ones that have observed that. Even the drug czar, John Walters, said I guess it was about 6 months ago, maybe a year ago, he said that maybe it was time to look further up the chain. In other words, he was saying that we're just busting the same guys over and over again, feeding into this cycle, which is very intertwined with the cycle of poverty in inner cities. And even he's saying maybe it's time to shift our focus up the ladder a little bit. But like you said, the defendant profile is typical and easily predictable, and often they can't afford their own attorneys. And that was a big part of the scandal in Tulia, is that these guys, there were huge red flags in these cases. I mean, when they rounded these people up, they got the majority of them in this pre-dawn raid they did, where they got, you know, all the guys dressed in their SWAT uniforms, and they were trying to arrest everybody at once so nobody tips anybody else off. Well, they didn't find any drugs in any of the houses when they arrested these guys. And that was huge red flag number one. Big red flag number two was that they virtually all of them were accused of dealing powdered cocaine instead of crack cocaine, which was sort of the drug of choice in this little community that Coleman infiltrated. So there was plenty of low-hanging fruit for these defense attorneys to work for, to grab, but some of them just got terrible, terrible representation from their indigent defense attorneys, and that was a big part of the scandal, is the low, low standards that we've come to in Texas with respect to court-appointed attorneys.
Now, I know the Tulia defendants were able to split some multi-million dollar amount after settling with these task forces and so forth, but there are other instances, and two that come to mind right here in Texas. In Abilene, I believe there were 40 supposed dealers, all black, busted in one night in one of these roundups. And then again in Palestine, 72 dealers, all black, rounded up. And yet the investigation, the analysis of this scenario is not given the attention, and these people are still under the government thumb. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's two different sort of phenomenon going here that you kind of have to distinguish between. One is the trumped up charges and fabricated cases, you know, the outright fraud, and that's what you had in Tulia in most of the cases. And then in the other phenomenon that's going on here is simply targeting and racial profiling. I mean, you know, most people that are in the penitentiary are guilty of the crime they were accused of. But you have to ask who the drug war is targeting and who it's not targeting, and why it seems to be the same people over and over and over again getting run through the system, even though we know that dope is being used in every single part of town and is being bought and sold in every single part of town. And what I found in studying these burned task forces is that they love this kind of bust that Coleman did because it's so easy. They love to bust the penny ante crack dealers because, you know, as they would put it, it's cost effective. You know, everybody knows where these guys are, especially in the larger cities, because they're out there on the street doing it. And so they can claim progress by doing this, and they can rack up statistics, you know, number of arrests, amount of drugs confiscated. And the reason that was so important in Texas in particular is because these burn grant task forces, they had to compete with one another for this grant money every year. And they had to show that they were making more busts than the task force, you know, two counties over. And if they didn't, then they would lose out, you know, when it was time to re-up the grant. And in fact, this Tulia bust, I argue in the book, one of the reasons that Coleman's supervisors were so reluctant to question and look at the obvious red flags in the case is that they were greedy for the statistics that he was racking up for them.
And I think we should underline the reason for those stats, that per the number of arrests, it doesn't even necessarily have to be convictions, but just the number of arrests, they're then able to ask the government for the same or additional grant monies the following year, right?
Yeah, that's right. The good news is that after this civil suit that you mentioned in Texas, where the Tulians were able to sue and get about $6 million out of the city of Amarillo, it really put a black eye on the burn grant program, not only in Texas, but nationally, too. And a lot of task forces in Texas started to fold up because their insurance companies were asking them, you know, when is our next Tulia going to happen, you know, and how well are we going following the rules? And then the other thing that happened around that same time was that there were budget cuts in Washington. Some of the Homeland Security guys were kind of raiding the money from these drug war funds, and so the burn grant program has kind of had a bullseye on it for budget cutters, and it actually been drastically reduced since the Tulia scandal broke. such that now in Texas, we're down to only half as many task forces as we had in the late 90s. And supposedly, the writing on the wall is that this task force program is going to go away altogether in the state of Texas. Now, that doesn't mean the drug war is going to end in the state of Texas, but this is a huge number of narcs that would be unemployed if this task force actually did get folded altogether.
Now, Nate, this is outside the bounds of Tulia, I suppose, but I wanted to get your thoughts as a reporter. What is the fulcrum point? How can we shift the interpretation of data? And by this, what I'm talking about is when I talk to congressmen or even other reporters behind closed doors, they can agree with me. The drug war is a hopeless failure, that we need to do something about it. Now, I know it involves public participation. Alerting of officials, change this on our behalf. But when they already know the truth, I just wonder, is there a fulcrum point, some point of leverage with which we can help change their minds?
That's hard because, you know, like you say, when you get one-on-one with an elected official, even a Republican, in some cases, particularly a Republican, because a lot of times, you know, they get elected on these platforms of, I will protect the public interest, I will use your tax dollars wisely. And if you look at the numbers, clearly the drug war is not a wise use of funds. I mean, you know, the numbers don't lie. There are just as many people using drugs today as there were, you know, 20-odd years ago when they started the drug war. Drugs are just as widely available. In some cases, they're cheaper and more potent. So, it's a catch-22. You talk to these guys behind closed doors, they'll say, yes, I agree with you. But then, if they try to do something, you've got the police lobby squawking, you've got the DA squawking, you know, no. And particularly in the case of these burn grants, it's become like pork. It's become like any other federal program, you know. Anytime you try to close a military base or take away a highway, you know, you got the constituents back home that are upset and they'll call and write letters. Well, that happens too when they try to close these drug task forces down. So they're getting pressure from home. But, you know, I think what has allowed things to shift is and it has allowed that shifting of money that I was described earlier in the Department of Justice is that there just seems to be a different national priority now. And this is probably a little too reductive to say, but there seems to be a kind of a new boogeyman, and it's terror now. And nobody wants to talk about drugs anymore. They all want to talk about terror, and that seems to be sort of the central organizing principle of funding in Washington. And that, more than anything, seems to be sort of sucking the air out of the drug war to the degree that it has happened.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We've been speaking with Nate Blakeslee, author of Tulia, Race, Cocaine, and Corruption in a Small Texas Town. That publisher again?
It's Public Affairs.
Public Affairs, and I have had many discussions with friends of Nate, and I know he's dug down into this. I apologize for not having had the chance to read it yet. I'll be doing that here soon. Nate, any website, any closing thoughts you'd like to relay?
Yeah, you can check out the publicaffairsbooks.org. You can read a little more about the book, or you can look at it up on Amazon, of course, and read the reviews and read more about it. But I just want to say thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, and we thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Confusion, skin rash, agitation, nervousness, constipation, diarrhea, dizziness, headache, nausea, hallucinations. Time's up. The answer, Mylanted AR or Pepcid AC. Two more FDA-approved products.
I think I recorded that when I was the sickest I've ever been in my life. But anyway, coming up here soon, the nation of Canada is going to elect a new government. And I'm glad to say that we got a chance to speak with Eugene Oscapella up there in Canada. He's going to tell us a little bit of his interpretation.
I'm Eugene Oscapella. I'm an Ottawa lawyer and one of the founders of the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy. Canadian drug law is entirely federal law, so there is no equivalent to state drug laws in Canada. So the election of the next federal government is going to have a significant impact on the shape of Canada's drug laws. The party that appears poised to win is our most right-wing party, the conservative, what they call the Conservative Party, I guess the equivalent, broad equivalent to the Republican Party. And if it gets a majority government, there's a very real possibility that it's going to instead of looking more intelligently at drug laws, that it's just going to go ahead and pull out the tried and true political device of increasing the drug sentences. And the leader of the Conservative Party, Stephen Harper, when he was campaigning, was already speaking of introducing mandatory minimum sentences for some drug offenses, which would be a novelty for Canada, because there are no mandatory minimum penalties for drug offenses in Canada. And so the prospect of a Conservative government getting elected in Canada would not be good for drug policy reform in the country.
You know, each week I try to point out, we offer cash money to any drug warrior willing to come on the show and defend the policy of drug war. We're now offering the Dash Award, $100 to anybody out there who believes the drug war is a good thing, willing to write 250 words and then record it to go on the airwaves. And of course, that doesn't happen either. I want to recommend this week's Century of Lies program. We have about a dozen people talking about their attempts to engage the drug warriors, to get people from the DEA or law enforcement to debate this policy openly. And of course, it cannot be done. And so therefore, each week, we produce a little bit that we do on their behalf, because they are such cowards.
Let's take a minute to talk about the so-called war on pain relief. Now, in order to effectively relieve chronic pain, doctors must sometimes prescribe dangerous and highly addictive narcotics. The fact that these drugs are needed does not make them any less addictive or any less dangerous. Because of this irrefutable fact, the government has implemented a policy of regulation, overseeing doctors to ensure the safety of their patients. Drug legalization advocates often boast that opioids used under the care of a physician have resulted in zero deaths. What they don't tell you is that number is a direct result of the government's policy of regulation. Without federal standards, doctors could prescribe large amounts of dangerous narcotics unrestrained, and you could kiss that zero opioid deaths number goodbye. The fact is that these drugs are dangerous. Every year, more people overdose on prescription medication than all other illegal drugs combined. The fact is that these federal standards are put in place to protect you, the patient. Drug legalization advocates would have you believe that all federal standards are evil. But come on. These standards are in place to protect you. And the fact is, you need the government's protection. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Drug dealers rule the streets. Violence plagues our communities, and our children fill the prisons. And the drug war is being sold to us as the solution to these problems. But a quick look at history will show that the exact opposite is true, that the drug war is the cause of the problems and is, in fact, just the latest manifestation of the never-ending war on black people. For hundreds of years, slavery allowed those in power to treat black people with brutality and deny them justice. The Civil War ended slavery. For the next 100 years, Jim Crow allowed the powers that be to treat black people with brutality and deny them justice. The civil rights movement ended Jim Crow. Now, the drug war has replaced Jim Crow, and the brutality and injustice continue. Now, I'm old enough to remember the time before the drug war, before armed gangs, crack houses, and drive-by shootings. Richard Nixon, the president who originated the drug war, remembered his history, too. He remembered when alcohol prohibition created armed gangs, speakeasies, and drive-by shootings. He knew that a violent criminal black market was the predictable outcome of prohibition. So our drug problems, the problems of prohibition, are no accident. And the drug war is no solution. The Civil War and civil rights movements have not brought about civil behavior towards black people from those in power. I don't know if anything ever will. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
This is Phil Smith of the Drug War Chronicle with this week's corrupt cop stories for the Drug Truth Network. We usually tell you about a corrupt cop or a jail guard gone bad, but this week we have several cases of institutional corruption where either whole squads or entire departments are rotten. For example, in Berkeley, California, the police chief has ordered a criminal investigation into missing drugs after an internal audit found problems. The chief won't say what those problems are, but the local DA is warning of, quote, potential criminal violations, unquote. On the East Coast, in Baltimore, the police department is under siege after an entire Southwest Baltimore anti-drug unit has been shut down. Three officers are accused of raping a 22-year-old woman in the station house, then plying her with pot to keep her quiet. And when investigators in that case searched the squad room, they also found cocaine and marijuana in officers' lockers, as well as pornography, gambling equipment, and stolen guns. And in Pittsburgh, the Allegheny County Jail is short-staffed after six guards were arrested for drug sales this week. This comes after the arrest of two other guards for smuggling last year and the firing of 13 more in a sex for privilege scandal. There's more to each of these stories. Check them out online at www.stopthedrugwar.org.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
From the ruins of war-ravaged Afghanistan, the Bush administration has created the world's preeminent narco-state, a heroin factory that now produces 90% of the world's supply, about 1 million pounds each year. In his new book, State of War, New York Times reporter James Risen recounts a meeting of Bush's war cabinet in November 2004, in which former Secretary of State Colin Powell briefed the president on the need to address Afghan heroin production under U.S. occupation. Bush was reported to have agreed with Powell and forcefully added that he was determined not to, quote, waste another American life on a narco state, end quote. However, the issue was promptly shelved a few weeks later after strong military opposition. Mr. Risen also quotes a Green Beret Afghan veteran as saying troops in Afghanistan are given specific orders to ignore heroin and opium when discovered. In other news, the Wall Street Journal reported this week that opium is now being used as currency throughout Afghanistan. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
On January 18th, the National Association of Counties, otherwise known as NACO, reported on the impact of methamphetamine use on counties. This year's report focused on county hospital emergency rooms and on drug treatment programs. Last year's report focused on crime and on children. According to NACO, methamphetamine is regarded as the biggest drug problem counties face in all these areas. These reports were based on mere opinion surveys of county officials responsible for administering the programs in question. Opinions, not statistical data. The federal government collects data from emergency rooms around the country through their Drug Abuse Warning Network system, or DAWN. The DAWN system has its own methodological limitations, but at least the reports it generates are meaningful. According to the most recent DAWN report, stimulants, including amphetamines as well as methamphetamine, were involved in only 7% of hospital emergency room visits. Stimulants were the fifth most frequently mentioned class of drug in emergency room visits, but the fourth, if you don't count the number one drug, alcohol. It should be noted, which NACO does, many counties are the providers of last resort for people who need medical help, have no insurance, and no other choices. So county health care systems may be seeing a disproportionate number of the worst cases, and they certainly are underfunded. Yet we will have no way of knowing for sure what's going on until NACO starts producing good data instead of opinion polls. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. I want to thank Nate Blakeslee for joining us. He's the author of Tulia, Race, Cocaine, and Corruption in a Small Texas Town. I'm writing my book, working title, Drug Lord's Dream. I'm about 50% through. Next week on the Century of Lies program, our guest will be Eric Sterling, the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. And next week here on Cultural Baggage, it will be Gary S. Becker, Nobel laureate and world-renowned economist. I want you to pick up the mantle. I want you to carry the flag. I want you to help get it done, you know, because you're the ones that will eventually get this done. It's not me, you know. I'm just a spark. Hopefully you can be the explosion. It's up to you to get involved, to write a letter to your congressman. Please visit our website, which is endprohibition.org. You can get on board there. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of an abyss.